This audio is a recording of a Better Questions seminar on social movements and praxis made in March 2010 in Chelmsford.
This audio is of the questions and answers session that followed the presentations. You'll find the audio of the presentations at indymedia.ie, article 95976.
For more information on Better Questions, see thought-movement.blogspot.com.
Move on to a set of discussion-related questions or anything. There was a couple of questions that Shereva posed earlier on that are probably related to not just feminism, particularly around how to avoid being co-opted, how to not work for the state but work with and build alliances in situations where you might have hierarchies of oppression. Yeah, there's a couple of questions posed there. I don't know, does anybody have anything that they wanted to bring up on that?
Just on the question of institutionalisation and appropriation, I want to just say a few words about that in relation to an idea that was important in both what you were both talking about, which is the idea of experience and knowledge being linked to experience. And I'm just wondering, because it seems to me, for example, in feminist praxis or feminist epistemology or theory, that there's a danger that the form of knowledge that's produced and the way it's related to experience can be kind of identitarian, in the sense that your capacity to know is linked to a very defined subject position as, say, a woman. And I think there could be two problems with that. One is that there seems to be, or I feel there might be, kind of evidence to suggest that those kinds of knowledges are easily appropriated and institutionalized in the same way that black epistemologies in the States, I know that's happened to a lot as well. But the other thing is, and then also, are those kinds of approaches a little bit are not sufficiently emancipatory, precisely because in your capacity to know they link you to a fixed subject position. And this comes back to the idea of experience. I mean, if your concept of experience is very identitarian, like I have an experience as a working class person, I have an experience as a drug user, as a traveller, can that be, on the one hand, not very emancipatory, because it's linked to a very fixed subject position, and on the other hand, is that part of the problem of institutionalization and appropriation, like
post-structure or post-feminist kind of critique, and that's exactly kind of what you're saying there. That's kind of the stuff that they would say. And again, I have problems with that because it that kind of debate removes kind of the or it oftentimes when you look at the materialist world, the materialist structures in which kind of forms our identities, right? So my whole kind of way of looking at this is we are kind of products of, you know, this society, systems of oppression that we kind of operate in, become subjects of that as a result. But this whole notion of identities being fixed, and I think this is something separate from the whole thing around appropriation. I think that feminists are very conscious that identities actually aren't fixed, and this is why there is value in looking at personal experience, right? Experience isn't something that happens one time, in one-off kind of way as a result of being female, right? So there's this whole concept of something that Kimberly Crenshaw came up with called intersectionality, that our experiences, for example, are a product of kind of multiple interactions, multiple layers of oppression, and that these kind of change and take shape and vary over time. So it's not kind of building a meta, big, grandiose theory based on the subject woman, for example, but reverting it to kind of experiences and knowledge, it's making it, I think, less oriented, I would argue, anyway, within, on the basis of a fixed identity, and more so kind of basis of like a multiplicity of identities. Like, I mean, if I look at it from my personal experience, right, I came from a very working class background, and kind of my gender wasn't something that I was kind of aware of until I actually went to university and started learning about these things. My class position was something that I became very much aware of. But, you know, when I was talking about kind of hidden knowledges before in terms of socialist feminism, once I started kind of learning about feminism, I realized kind of this hidden knowledge that I had before in terms of how my, because of my gender and my class, for example, that my experiences took a particular shape. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, okay, it's you know, like, I think one of the issues, okay, I think this might be one of the issues. If we heard like a feminist perspective, we heard a Ferrarian perspective there. In a sense, those are not ideas which have very much purchase in contemporary academia. Okay, they're not very up to date ideas. It was like a 70s and 80s greatest hits here today, okay? No, I mean, this, I think if we had somebody speaking from a Bourdieu perspective, or you two have been speaking today, we might have more of an argument about this type of stuff. And I'll be interested in people staking out their claim in opposition to that, just for the sake of a good discussion. Because I think there are problematic things with what I said there. I think there's some very problematic things with the way we understand university knowledge. I'm committed to university research for a whole set of reasons, but I'm very sceptical of it. And I wonder how people position themselves within that. I think that would be a way we could have a more general discussion. Is that clear?
I think part of the problem is, though, that, like, in terms of having general discussions, like, for instance, the question about dealing with the oppressionary forces of the state, right? I don't think actually it serves great function to tackle a subject like that in very general terms, because I think that in order to be an emancipated individual and not be carrying structures that you've created in your mind to do with peer groups and associations and whatever, in order to actually be an emancipated individual, as opposed to I'm somebody struggling for freedom against the oppressive forces of the state, in order to do that, I think it's necessary to cease to perceive the state and the oppressive forces as a singular entity. I think it's much healthier, I think, for the mind, for the self, to approach every issue as an individual issue. There is a subject, and I can deal with that subject. I have the capacity to isolate something to a set of circumstances, but I can categorise things into usable problems and solutions and approaches and thereafter. If we make the mistake of trying to bundle the whole thing into one big box, we end up, I'm fighting the oppressionary forces of the state, which happens to be also the education system and the health system and everything else. I don't think that's functional. I think it's one of the great problems of what's traditionally called left politics, is that left politics, by its very nature of its oppositionary format, left and right, oppressed, unoppressed, or oppressor, whatever, by taking on that very nature, we are necessarily enforcing the reality that there is an oppressor. And I think that if we want to evolve beyond that, and I think that the most interesting thing for me personally that I've come across in feminist theory is cyborg theory. I think cyborg theory is fascinating. And I think one of the great things about cyborg theory is that it speaks about tearing apart this constructed reality that we are against. And we construct it partially by creating an identity for ourselves as fighting. So I think it's very difficult to actually deal with those sort of things of opposing the state as a general question, because it's not about opposing the state, it's about opposing particular conditions, I think.
As a simple, a simple technique that you could farm cyborg ecology.
Yeah. Well, cyborg theory is basically just about the idea that we're actually all interfaced and interconnected, and that, you know, to define yourself as being separated from something is automatically to cut your harm. That's largely what cyborg theory is about. So, cyborg theory, so for instance, the idea of harnessing the powers of the state is totally. And therefore it's cyborg theory, because you are part of it. We are all part of it, and we might not like think of some of it, but like we pay tax every time we buy something in a shop, so we are part of that, those currently hegemonic and largely patriarchal systems. That's most of it. But because we are part of it, we also have the ability to alter it. And every action that you take is an action to alter it. Yeah. Because politics is ontological. An ontology is like a constructive reality. It's your understanding of the reality. So like, for instance, so the Freire idea of there's a set of circumstances, let's deal with that set of circumstances, and then let's think about it again, and then let's go back into it. That's the kind of thing we're talking about.
The difference is that, and John, I'm saying this for the purpose of application, is that he says you have to still have a horizon of possibility which is inspired by very old-fashioned universal idea.
Yeah,
he believes in an emancipatory project which is informed by that sort of vision.
Yeah, I think there's a difference. I don't think critiquing the state is...
Yeah, no, but it's that balance between the particular and the universal and retaining... I think that's an issue here. And also whether... everything is on an experiential level. I don't think it is. I think a lot of structures, a lot of our social experience is determined at a different level. And they're enduring structures. You know, like, I'm a realist about this. I think, you know, it's not simply good enough to say, I curse all your houses.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I personally don't feel myself to be part of a beneficiary of the international financial system. I'm certainly going to live with consequences, don't I?
Yeah, but we put part.
And I can't fight it unless I have some sort of unified notion of how it works and how it interacts.
Yeah, but part of our perceived slavery is the fact that we do take the couch.
I think I like your questions about why Paulo Freire at a certain point was more worldwide known as a theoretician, as an activist. And I think it is because he was a pedagogist, and I believe that it is really useful when we talk about education, when we talk about popular education or whatever, to make the distinction between pedagogy and education. And I think to talk about education is a means of being in a certain way co-opted by the state. There is that risk, because education is, in general, a function of the state, intending the state in a broader sense, in the sense that education is everywhere. Education has to do with the reproduction of social condition, of whatever social condition, from hygienic condition to other cultural condition. Pedagogics, and there are not many pedagogics, is to think about education in a different way. It's like to project your thought not coextensively to education, not to think within education in order to change it, but to think about education in the way of a fractal. And I think it is what Paulo Freire did, and some other pedagogists worldwide famous that are not so many. There are not so many famous pedagogies. And I think this is this is a means of thinking about education without being co-opted in its state function. That is always really risky. When it's
I think that's largely true.
Do you know if Ferry talked discussing multiple intelligence theory at all?
No, I don't. And I've read most of the stuff, but I don't think so. I mean, I think there's, what you said so far, there's a bunch of great debates, and maybe you should check out who develops a theory of distributed intelligence, and it's very interesting. It's like sort of a learning theory.
Can I ask you a question? Because you made reference there to Donna Haraway and the whole manifesto. What do you? How do you think, kind of practically, that has value?
I think one very obvious example of how those types of thoughts in general have practical. Are having a practical change in the world is they've changed, instance, the traditionally hierarchical model of corporation is changing, and it's becoming cellular and modular. And as it becomes cellular and modular, the power is not only being sort of diversified throughout the corporation, but what's happening is it's actually becoming diversified throughout the client base. So, for instance, if you look at IT, because IT is a classic sphere of this, although there are several others, IT companies are no longer set about product development by having a little think tank at the top of the organisation that sets the agenda for everything. What they actually do now is they actually interface with their customer base, and they're even advertising the idea, like all the ads for the new Windows systems or whatever. It's all about, oh, this was my idea. They're promoting the fact that they're actually engaging with their customer base as opposed to dealing with a hierarchical kind of production of product now, as it happens, discernment of product and whatever is another issue. But there's a very practical example of how theories like have a practical application in society. If you take the same idea and you apply it to politics, the formation sporadically almost in a way of lots of cells of diverse reactionary political groups and their interactions and how they then set new agendas through the formation of things like, for instance, the World Social Forum, the Equentials appear in the 90s. Those sort of meetings. That's taking those ideas of the importance of the unit and its interactions to every other unit. It's taking those ideas and putting them into practice. I
have a question maybe for both of you actually, in terms of looking at the cycle of praxis of like action, reflection, and somewhere in that process there is a sort of a migration into the means through which these things can be co-opted, whether it's studies, feminist studies being pulled into the university and being branded as women's studies, or whether it's community education projects being pulled in within underneath the state. And what seems to be happening is that there doesn't seem to be a sort of a balance between using the resources of the state and also maintaining a distance from it at the same time, maintaining that critical reflection from outside of it. Or maybe there is within, a lot of stuff that's happening in South America or wherever, and maybe some feminist groups that have managed to keep a cycle of praxis without managing to engage with co-opting powers.
I don't think there's one answer to it. Maybe. I think the real issue is that there's so much resources. In terms of the university, and so many people are spending their time getting formed within the university environment. Some of this, trying to grasp things from the outside, becomes very difficult. I mean, for instance, I would say most people here spend good amount of time in higher education, but I would say most people haven't been involved in a sustained popular education initiative or some sort of practical activism. I think there's a good reason for that. I'm not criticising that, but I think we're getting drawn into this situation whereby the institutions define our coordinates a lot. It's like Michael Burroway says, you know, in the 70s, sociology imbibed feminism and Marxism and whatever, but it vomited out the radicalism, and all you're left is with this sort of gestural politics. Like, and if every person I read who makes radical noises in the paper was involved in a sort of praxis-type way, we'd have a lot more stuff going on. And I haven't really squared that one, you know, because I think, and this is why it's a shame you weren't talking about Bourdieu today, because I think he has a particular answer to this. He says that there's a certain use for social scientific knowledge, and it can be of use to social movements, but he acknowledges the reality of the way the university is today in a way that I don't think either of our presentations do. You know, just how much activity is going on there, rather than trying to reinvent it outside, which is very roundabout and not really answering your question. Sorry.
I don't know if you could elaborate a little bit more on what Bourdieu or on what he has to say about the values of knowledge that's produced from within the university.
Go ahead, is that something
you might... Okay, well, I mean, you would say that the type of Ferrarian thing that I am pushing there is like, reduces itself very easily to an account of accounts. It just simply becomes a series of sort of collection of stories, and that it's an idealised, romanticised notion of how knowledge gets created. And so you would say, here there's a particular scientific field in which there's struggles, and it's, you know, the important thing is to struggle to try and define that field. So you don't redefine the university outside the university and do it internally, you know, and that's quite a realistic but limited strategy. And Burroway does something interesting because he pulls on Freire and Bourdieu. Do people know Michael Burroway? He's an ethnographer. He's an interesting guy, but he sort of goes, look, you need a dual strategy, essentially. You can't have critical social science without mass social movement, and that has to be your point of reference. You have to create public sociology. Otherwise, it's blah, blah, it's vomit. It's just the same old rubbish, and we hear it all the time. But on the other hand, if you don't realise that the knowledge is structured in these fields, and you have to understand the rules of the game, to use a very Bourdieu phrase, unless you work to those rules of the game, you won't win. You know, that's it. You have to dominate journals. You have to make certain arguments, and you have to use certain language. So I think that dual strategy is probably, for the type of society we live in, more realistic. It's the question of how those intersect, then, I think.
I think it's really fun because the last time me and Paddy made some examples about political movements of the 70s, especially me, because Bourdieu is really into 78, it's really gives really value to the political sequence that he thinks finished that. And we were in a way criticized, saying that maybe there is too much fixation on that political sequence. But then what I see is that at the end of the day, when we are trying to make an example about what is popular education, for example, or what is feminist, and we want to find an example where theory and praxis, where when the university was working, I mean, when sociology was pumping up clinical theory, so we have to get back to that period, you know? It is like this. Although now there are social movements, there is anti-capitalism, there are lots of things going on, you know? But it's not the same. So what what the big question is, what ended up there? Like, what is the problem now? So, and where do we have to start? We have to start thinking about our act on social movement and discussing about what is the left or what is not the left, and to make all the divisions, all the sectarian divisions between actual, present anarchist or Negrian autonomous. Or we have to think really universally what that epoch brought to an end, because it is impossible to, you know, re-induct politics from nothing. I completely agree with you. I'm also critical with the academia, and and I was involved in social movements as well, but I think sometimes the experience you have in social movement is so poor, and so frustrating that it's much more intellectually stimulating, and you think you are doing a bigger political task in keeping yourself alone in your room and read an interesting book of a writer and rethink about, you know, I don't know. So even Lenin after the October Revolution started reading Hegel. I mean, like, you know, sometimes there is a need. So I wouldn't distrust completely the academia in this sense.
No, I mean, here's the thing. I don't know if people have any more patience, right? But there is a practical example of how you can do this sort of Freirean or feminist form of practice and engage with the power of the university. And I think if we'd been positioned slightly differently at the beginning of the financial crisis, we could have had popular education networks linked to social movements and linked to the university that could have brought both expert knowledge and social experience together in a very interesting way. And this isn't totally pie in the sky. That is what the Metro Movement for Social Justice in Canada was doing. It's precisely what they did, is they ran economic and political literacy workshops, but they did it at a series of levels, everything from very basic to graduate. And what they did is they got people saying, okay, you're interested in this, we'll source people who have a particular expertise, because I think we live in a very complex, differentiated society, and we have to recognise that expertise does exist on some sort of level. And they did some very interesting stuff. They changed a local budgeting. They won against a local budget on the basis of this mobilisation. But I think we'd be positioned differently if we don't.
It is interesting that there is a policy government from the Department of Education here. It's to do with secondary level education, where they actually haven't done anything about it, but they did publish a policy document a couple of years ago about it, basically saying that it was the policy of the Department of Education in Ireland to review the ways in which curricula are designed and implemented in secondary schools in order to diversify part of the multiple intelligence idea that they actually want to try, and initially through cross-curricular activities initially, but then with a view to curriculum modification, but they actually wanted to try and create another way of dealing with intelligence in the education system, you know, as opposed to what we currently have. And quite possibly the universities won't actually change until the people going into them have changed, and the people going into them are actually coming maybe with some stronger critical capabilities, and then there'll actually be a requirement of the university's part to actually react to that situation. So maybe alteration of university practices and the traditional methods will actually have to be forced by raising the game at the start.
Can I address that? I, I'm very skeptical. I mean, when I was doing my PhD, I was full of, you know, promise and hope, and wow, I could, you know, engage in kind of all these intellectual ideas and kind of apply them practically. But once I started working within the system, I became very jaded. Like, it's the university, you know, as kind of an entity, it's just become something of a great kind of example of, you know, a business model of education, this kind of consumer model of education. The stuff that's coming down through administration in terms of trying to impose control over us in terms of what we teach and how we can teach it. And it's engaging in a process of monitoring, which is becoming just even more increasingly difficult as each year goes on. And this is coming down from European regulations around education too. So it's getting much more restrictive in terms of what we can do. And so I don't even think that bringing in more critical people or more people who are committed to kind of change.
I'm not saying as staff, I'm saying as students.
As a student
body, because university education is to a certain extent self-led to a certain sense, certainly much more so than it is in the school system. Now, if in the school system you have an education process which is more self-led, then by the time somebody is 17 or 18, their critical faculties and their ability to self-lead their education should be well enough developed that they are able to go more confidently in more diverse paths, even through a relatively stringent system. And that very action if a generation of college goers were capable of kind of hitting the ground running, like a mature student coming back to college with a bit of a talk, you know what I mean? And using the resources. If a whole generation of people were actually going into college, like, on that sort of a pace in terms of knowledge bank utilisation, you know, that in turn must have some consequential knock-on effects to the staff and the processes within the college.
Is that really what the Department of Education and Student meant?
Well, they've kind of said that they're obliged to move a policy in that kind of direction.
Yeah. They have a policy for everything in France.
Yeah, of course.
There's shelves in the Department of Education that's like groaning with pious intentions. I mean, if you have 35 kids in the classroom again, video top, there is, and you've delayed it 45 minutes, you are not teaching according to what you are telling them.
Yeah.
And you are certainly not asking them to predict beyond their knowledge.
Yeah.
It's just not possible. You know, the leavings, really what people are interested in, university level and at school level, is getting through the system. And people understand to get through the system, you play the game.
Yeah.
And like, it's a far more preventive
thing. People are taught to do that from...
Of course they are, yeah. It's smart.
Yeah.
You know, you'd be an idiot to fight against it. Yeah.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, I don't think, from my perspective anyway, I don't think the problem is that people don't have knowledge of their own circumstances or whatever, but that the left, our radical politics, seems to be incapable of registering contemporary experience in an emancipatory way. And you get a lot of, like, from feminists, I think there's often a sense of frustration that feminist politics doesn't resonate with women in general anymore. But I think a lot of that is because it's based, feminist knowledge and politics is based on an experience that either no longer exists or has been really radically fragmented, so that people's experience of gender now, or women's experience now, is for example, it's not articulated around public-private division to the extent that it would have been in the 50s, to give one example. And that's why I think it's really important to think about this idea of practice, because I think what we need to do now is very much go back to actual experiences of contemporary capitalism and gender relations and so on, and have that kind of humility that you were talking about, Fergal, and really engage him with the kind of raw experience of what it means to live in Dublin, but to try and find some kind of way of reading that experience that can open in an emancipatory way, which just seems to be so difficult at the moment.
Yeah, but I think what Freire did is that he did a lot of research himself. You know, he was not an academic, but before... No, we were talking about the Edinburgh experience. Like, before developing their movement or their own institution, they did a lot of research. Maybe they were not related to the academia or just they had some links. I think it's really important. It's not to underestimate.
Okay, well, maybe we'll just wrap it up then. Thanks very much.
This audio is a recording of a Better Question seminar on social movements and praxis made in March 2010 in Shomer Spree.
The audio was recorded and edited by Andrew Flood. You'll find more audio at anarchism.pageabode.com/cat/andrew-flood.